This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Let's talk about power in the world. In the 1930s, the major countries of the world used to be called the Great Powers. In the 1970s and 80s, they were the superpowers. These days, maybe there's only one left. Maybe with another one on the rise. But plenty of countries have had their turn in ruling the world. Ancient Rome, ancient Greece, ancient Egypt, the Ottoman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, the British Empire. And at other times, the Spaniards, the French, the Portuguese, the Russians, the Austro-Hungarians, and that's just the Europeans. Why do some powers rise and then fall? And what can we learn about the past to help predict the future, for example, of the American Empire? And what about the Chinese? Will they be next to take their turn at imposing their worldview on the world? That's what we're doing on Talking Point this morning, looking at the great world powers from the 1500s to the present day and the superpowers of the future. And we're doing that because we're joined by the person who wrote The Authority, the book on this very subject. Paul Kennedy is the author. Is the author of that book and editor of 19 books, and is a professor of history at Yale University. He's currently working on a new edition of his famous 1988 book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Paul Kennedy, what a pleasure it is to have you on the program. Welcome to Overnights.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Rod.
Tell us about that book you wrote or was published in 1988, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. What was its purpose? And why have you decided to look at a fresh edition of it? You know, what's happened since then? What's happened in the last 30-odd years?
Let's go with the first question. I was putting together a history of great powers diplomacy over a long period of time, from about the formation of the early modern states in Europe back in the 1500s through to after the Second World War. And by the time I was writing this book, Rod, I had moved from my native England to take up this position in Mr. Reagan's America in the 1980s. And I was struck by the competition in the final stages of the Cold War between Moscow and Washington. I was struck by the fact that each of those countries were suffering from a lot of internal economic pressures and stress, some of which reminded me of my story of Imperial Spain under Philip II. And so I decided to redefine the beginning of my book and to give it the title of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, Economic Change and Military Conflict Since 1500. Many of your listeners who are history book fans will know that you often have to go to the subtitle of the book to get the essence of what's in the book. The title itself might be an overly dramatic one. The subtitle tells you what's there. Economic change, on the one hand, and military conflict, on the other, since 1500. And then that story, from time to time, the number one great power of the half century found itself under severe competition from rising powers, found itself overstretched. I kind of invented a word called imperial overstretch and had to give ground. And that went on up and down, over the 500 years at least that I was looking at this story of the great powers. That's the essence of it, Rod.
You know, I mean, I'd love to start at the beginning, but I want to jump to the end then, and the end of that battle between, well, we thought it was the end of the battle between, say, the Soviet Union and the United States there at the end of the 80s into the 90s. And then the next thing that the US had to deal with after the demise of the Soviet Union as a great power was not another great power that rose and challenged the American hegemony in the world. But in fact, it was kind of a mouse biting them, and that is, you know, the Al-Qaeda or something like that. That in fact, the Americans weren't prepared for that. You know, will that eventually bring down the US as a power, not another power, but in fact a smaller bite into their empire?
So that's where we go. That's where we jump now to the end of the story. When I was finishing off the book, there was great evidence that Mr. Gorbachev, for all his efforts, could not affect the demise of the Soviet Union, that the United States was overstretched, so it seemed, overspending on the military under Reagan. And then with the collapse of one of those two superpowers, all seemed nice and nifty for the United States through the 1990s. This was the time of the New World Order. And if there were any of these smaller nations like Saddam or whatever, you just swiped them. America had come back again to be number one. And then it gets attacked 20 years ago this September in 9/11. And again, it's a story of a small mouse biting its bum and the U.S. responding. And yet the larger story, Rod, of can this number one world power sustain itself decade after decade when the economic challenges to it are large and when it's definitely showing signs of some overstretch, means that the thesis of rise and fall may not be out of date after all.
So there are similarities. I mean, there's that old line about history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. There are similarities all the way through about the decline of these great powers. Have we always had at least one great power imposing itself on the world or trying to maintain a balance of power? Has that always been the case? Or have there been times when countries were able to just work out their own business for themselves?
Boy, am I glad you asked that story, because over the time I've always get asked, well, what's the next number one? As it was the assumption being that if number one falls, then number two comes in to be number one. And my reply has been, looking at the historical record, Rod, there were times when, say, at the beginning of the 18th century, the number one of France, say, under Louis the 14th, falls back. But what you then have is about 30, 40, 50 years of a number of rival contending great powers, France, the Netherlands, the Habsburg Empire, Great Britain. It's hard to tell who among those. So why can't we go from a certain period in history of it being a distinct number one, the superpower or whatever you call it, to another period of history where it's kind of uncertain who might emerge as the next leader, but power is shared in a multipolar world system.
Take some calls in just a moment. In fact, and we'll kind of jump to the end with maybe the end of the American Empire. I mean, I think that's probably a little bit premature. But let's go back to the end of the British Empire. Owen wants to ask a question about that. Owen, good morning.
Good morning, Rod and Paul. Yes, I'm curious about what role your Paul thinks that World War II decided for the collapse of the British Empire. Because, I mean, already it was undermined by the Indian independence movement, which was partly caused by Britain's refusal to give Indian law autonomy. And I'm wondering, but I think it was World War II that was really decisive, not only in eroding a lot of the resources and money that the British Empire had, but it also contributed to a mentality that, among its inhabitants of its empire, that Britain was no longer, because it had lost so much territory during World War II, that Britain was no longer the sort of overall superpower capable of maintaining control that it used to be.
All right, Owen, thanks very much for that. Appreciate it. So the end of the British Empire, did it happen the end of World War One? Did it happen at the end of World War Two? Were they just lucky in a way that the American Empire began perhaps at the end of World War Two? What brought about the end of the British Empire?
Well, they were lucky in the First World War, Rod, to find that after 1917, the rising big power, the democracy across the Atlantic Ocean of Woodrow Wilson's United States came in and tilted that big battle so memorable in the Australian account of history turned that big war into a victorious war. But those 20 years of the so-called interwar period gave a sense of a kind of false return. The British Empire had acquired new territory in the Middle East. It was suppressing nationalist movements. And in India, it was suppressing nationalist movements there. It gave a sense, a false sense maybe, of still being the British Empire as a superpower. Underneath, its economy was not as competitive as others. And when it was challenged by the triple revisionist of Nazi Germany, Mussolini's Italy, and then in the Far East after 1941, Japan, it just couldn't hold. At the same time as it was being challenged by those three outsiders, it was, as your questioner pointed out, being challenged from within, challenged from across India in the movements of the nationalist independent movements there, slightly later on in the challenges of nationalist movements out of Africa. Many of the African soldiers of the West African Rifles, etc., come back home and ask, for what were we fighting? So the Second World War decisively gives the pushover into the post-1945 world of new superpowers.
Okay, now Glenn wants to ask about that as well. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, and good morning, Paul. Looking at the differentials between the two empires, I mean, Britain was an empire that ran for hundreds of years. But its benefit was that it imported all its raw materials from all its colonies, manufactured the finished product, and sold them back to its colonies.
Yeah.
And effectively had a circular economy. And being a manufacturer, that's where it made its money. Now, America was different because it didn't import from anywhere. The only raw material the United States ever did import in any major quantity was oil from the Middle East. And therefore, it wasn't a circular economy that relied on trade with its sub-colonies per se. So how did America become such a huge power other than through the mechanism of supplying armaments and munitions for wars?
All right, very, very good question. How did America do it, Paul?
Okay, very good question. Thank you for asking this one. So how do you become the number one power when the two entities you're talking about in this comparison are so different? One is a cluster of small islands off the northwest of Europe with very few natural resources, as George Orwell pointed out, apart from potatoes and herring. And the other is a gigantic continent or demi-continent with almost everything it needs, raw materials, grain, ores, oil from Pennsylvania, long before it needs it in the Middle East, so self-contained, so powerful. So the U.S. grows its economic power from within, with the organization coming from the railroad and the Industrial Revolution. The U.S., the nifty Brits, have to turn it around using the great advantage of Western sea power after the Napoleonic Wars, after Trafalgar, to reach out, control the raw materials of many places across the globe, import them, as you say in your question, process them, and then sell them at a higher added value. It was a nifty trick in history, and it lasted, I would say, a good 150 years before the Second World War and internal changes brought it down.
So the British Empire staggered. It didn't really fall the way that some other empires have fallen and lost their power over their colonies, perhaps. The British Empire faced some revolts and revolutions, yes, in others, but in other cases they just gave power back to those colonies, and the Commonwealth still exists today as a functioning enterprise. So Britain, you know, for all its faults as an empire, was able to at least step away the way that other empires weren't able to do. Is that right?
Yes, it's right, Rod. And I really like your verb staggered. I was going to add to that, the British Empire staggered and then decided to sit down.
Yes, exactly.
Like an old lady. So it took some hits. The Suez Crisis of 1956. Before then, had been the smart pulling out of India and the Indian independence granting in 1947. British Empire thought for a while it could reconstitute itself across Africa and the Middle East. And then that smart Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, came along and said, no, the winds of change are sweeping right across Africa. We got to get out nimbly by handing over. It looks like a peaceful transfer of power. We're not going to crash down like the French in Vietnam or Algeria. And so it's going to be, we're going to send out members of the royal family to be there at the flag pulling down ceremony. And we're going to develop this nifty word General Smuts put together at the end of the First World War, the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth. And we're going to get those wonderful self-governing dominions who helped us so much in the two world wars as lead members of this Commonwealth, and then invite the other members in. It was a staggering by a rather clever old lady who finally decided to sit down.
Paul Kennedy is our guest. Britain, though, was, I suppose, lucky, fortunate, whatever you want to say, that the power that took over from them, the United States, basically had the same aims. They weren't the colonizers that the British had been, but they believed in the rule of law to, you know, the extent that the British did as well. They believed in open elections. They believed in the same sorts of things. Is that what normally happens when one, the leadership of one empire changes to another?
No, not at all. That whole story of a 500 rise and, rise and fall over 500 years is rather more of the staggering number one power being very resentful of and deciding to contest the growing challenger power and having very little in cultural or linguistic or constitutional terms to be the same. Spain was so totally different from, say, the Dutch Republic of the Netherlands, different religion, different constitutions, different everything else like that. In the case of the British and the Americans, as you say, there was a whole lot of things which could be emphasized by pretty smart public relations on the part of successive British prime ministers like Balfour and, of course, Churchill, the common good, the common aims, to gloss over the fact that the United States was, in many other ways, Rod, a very different animal from Great Britain, but you could keep the two together, and the two were kept together even better because of the challenge of Kaiser's Germany and then the challenge of Hitler's Germany and the Japanese.
Yeah, just on Hitler, who inevitably comes up. If he had decided that the German Empire would be throughout other parts of the world and not Europe, we wouldn't perhaps have had World War II, and there may have been a competing power in the 40s and 50s, perhaps, along with the UK, along with the US. That would have been Germany, but instead Hitler decided to invade his neighbouring countries rather than take over countries in Africa.
Well, Hitler had to get to Africa by the late 1930s. Hitler would have had to come across a very suspicious British Empire.
Okay,
British were all in favor of letting the United States expand in the Western Hemisphere. That it had been doing so in political expansion from the 1900s onwards. The more America expanded in the Pacific, that was pretty good too, Rod, because it was a counter to the rising Japanese threat.
Yep.
But Hitler, if he went eastward, some conservative Britons didn't mind that either. If he knocked out the blasted communists of Joe Stalin, that would be okay. The problem was when Hitler builds an air force which could challenge British integrity at home, and when Hitler is building submarines, and when Hitler joins Mussolini, then that's too close to call, too close to home.
Okay. David has texted in on 0467 922 702. David says, isn't the larger story that the US is showing all the internal traits of a failed state? Rise of the excessive rich, huge inequality, and the breakdown of a functioning democracy. Are you able to look at the US now, maybe in the last 4 or 5 years, and see the same sorts of things that have happened in empires before?
Yes, I am. This is really a core question for me, Rod. For a large number of years, I turned down all of the requests from publishers, from fellow scholars, from institutions to write the second edition of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. My argument there was if you rush in to write a second edition, you could be hidebound by the like concerns of a day. Give your story, give your argument 25 years or so and come back to the book then, because of a number of other books I wanted to write in 1906 on the reform of the UN, the Parliament of Man, and a book in 1913 on scientific decision makers in the Second World War. I'm only coming back to it now, Rod, and I'm conscious of the kind of drumbeat of some of the repetitions of history. And I'm conscious of the fact that in this great country where I'm now teaching at Yale University, there's a great deal of concern that the US may be following the track of failed large empires of the past because it cannot get its domestic politics or structures in good order.
Paul Kennedy is the author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Let's go back then to the 1500s, where it kind of all begins, or the modern powers, perhaps. What was the state of the world in 1500?
1500, I thought, was a good time to start, not just, Rod, because it's a nice round date in world history, right? But you've got 1,000 here, you've got 2,000 there, and you've got 1,500 in the middle. But because a whole lot of interesting things were happening just around and before or after. The gigantic old empire of the successor Roman Empire had collapsed in the Ottoman takeover of Constantinople in 1453. Columbus had gone off and discovered the United States. And Vasco da Gama and others were going off around the bottom end of South Africa in just about 1490, 1506 or something like that. The new states of Western Europe were different from the medieval states. They had an organization. They had a fundraising capacity. They had effective growing bureaucracies. They had tax-paying systems, and they had monarchs who were rivaling each other, but they were self-contained in their own new monarchies of that time. So you have a beginnings of a modern great power system, modern bureaucracies, modern military revolution type of things, and a chance for Europe to push out across the globe.
So did any empire, whether it be the Spaniards or the Portuguese or the Dutch at this time, did any of them do this without, you know, colonizing and then taking the wealth of those colonies?
The biggest and most successful European empire of 1500 to like 1550 was undoubtedly the Habsburg Empire. For a long while under that Emperor Charles V, he combined the Spanish Habsburg dominions, and that wasn't just the Iberian Peninsula, but a lot of the Mediterranean, with the Austrian Habsburg Empire lands, including Burgundy and the Low Countries, and that one looked a real biggie. And a large amount of that was acquisition of territory by dynastic marriage. Uh-huh. Everybody was very jealous of the Habsburgs. They made increasing numbers of acquisitions through nifty marriages of the younger sons of the younger daughters. But they, in their turn, were going out externally and fighting. And under Habsburg Spain, there was this turn also to the New World, to supporting the empires of conquest in Mexico and Peru and elsewhere, and taking over the Portuguese, who were beginning to conquer parts of Brazil and Africa. So there was no real example of a rising state which did not try to use military force to expand the areas that it wanted to have control of.
Why did France rise? What was it? Was it just because of Napoleon, or were there others in the French Empire that saw what perhaps Spain had done and wanted to emulate that?
If, Rod, think of it like this, if one of the contending big states in late medieval France, whether it was the Valois kings, or whether it was Burgundy, or whether it was big states in Normandy and Anjou and et cetera, if one of them was nifty enough to have a relatively good succession of young males to be king, if they were nifty enough to begin to get control of a taxation system over France, which paid for things, if it could create a newer French standing army and eliminate the internal contenders, as the kings of France did at the end of the 15th century, then France had a lot of natural things going in its favor. It was a far larger population than England across the waters. It had great external boundaries and barriers. The Rhine to the east, the Atlantic to the west, the soft low countries to the north, the Pyrenees to the south. If it could mobilize its like 14 million inhabitants and get them paying taxes for a large French army, it was on a rise. And it showed itself to be on a rise, even though internal religious wars through the late 16th and early 17th centuries, it had the natural strength and resources if it could organize itself. And this happens well before Napoleon.
What about the religious differences? I mean, most of these countries were Catholic. Did that make it any easier or different for these rival powers? Or what happens when they encounter different religious beliefs?
It's a really interesting question, which one can twist and turn in many ways, Rod. The Max Weber, the German sociologist, political sociologist, had a great book on religion and the rise of capitalism. And he argued that the Catholic states of the 16th and 17th centuries were not so well equipped because of the church's strictures on interest, on usury, and were kind of backward-looking and a bit too theological. It was going to be the modern rising Protestant states of the Netherlands and then England after the Reformation, and then, later on the Protestant German states and Sweden, which were to be at the fore. A whole number of people, historians, have fought back and said there were very successful cases of Catholic capitalism. And what's more, these Catholic states in the South seem to have been able to develop power in a very strong way, though fighting the Protestants for 150 years till the wars of religion were over. So religion plays a role, and it drives a number of people, certainly like Philip II of Spain. It doesn't drive that calculating Queen Elizabeth of England, for whom religion was just a bit of a nuisance in the backside, because there were too many religious ideologues in her country, and she would much prefer to be a temperate and tolerant religious person and get on with the development of Greater England.
David has a question similar to this. Good morning, David.
Oh, hello, Rod, and hello.
Paul Kennedy is our guest. Yeah.
Thank you, yes. Look, notwithstanding that, as you've been mentioning, there's been a lot of rivalries from like-minded or like sort of cultures that share the same traditions and in the Judeo-Christian traditions, but I'm just wondering how much it sort of challenges and focuses the collective minds of the Western powers, such as the US, when there's a culture that is has no shared traditions such as China, or I remember Japan. I'm sure Dr. Kennedy would remember when Japan seemed to be back up and challenging America. And I wonder how much that when it comes in the country that's rising up is from a non-Judeo-Christian background, how much extra worry that creates when they don't seem to share our values, or you know, rule of law or democracy. Or
a different type of law. David, thanks very much. Very, very interesting question. Paul?
I think that's a great question. I can remember, David, when Rise and Fall of the Great Powers first came out in 1988, it had on its front cover a kind of medieval wall of clock of fortune with, Great Britain, Uncle Sam at 15:15. Clearly he's gone. US just stepping off the top of 12 noon and a rising Japanese figure coming up. And here was for the first time, it was thought, David, in history, a successful economic and maybe future military great power who was not a Western one, maybe not sharing our Western traditions. People had memories of Japan in the Second World War as well. What do you do when that happens and you get worried that the guy on the top is not like you in your democracy, in your tolerance, in your constitutions, and in your Judeo-Christian traditions? This is going to be, David and Rod, the big question as we watch the steady advance of China in world affairs as a big and increasingly obvious contender for the number one position.
There's something else I want to talk about just as we get to the end of the 1700s. How important do you think was the loss of the colonies in America, the United States, and the revolution to the UK or to Britain, to England, to eventually defeating France and Napoleon, at Waterloo and Trafalgar in the first decades of the 19th century, that in fact if Britain had kind of tried to hold on to their colonies in the US, there may have been a different result in Europe under Napoleon and in that era.
What an interesting period in history, Rod, the late 18th century must have been, from about 1760 through into the great wars of the French Revolution. You've got to put this in the mind of listeners. You have at least in the West, like three rival revolutions going on at the same time. They're so very different. One has been the American Revolution, the idea of the independence and self-government of the states. The second is going to come a little later on, a different political constitutional challenge of the French. More revolutionary, more on the ground, challenging property revolution. But there's a third revolution in that period, which historians refer to, Rod, as the Industrial Revolution. My word, just as Great Britain is losing the American Empire, the steam industrial factory revolution is developing hand over foot in the country which lost the colonies. So by the time you get into the war with Napoleonic France, you have a Great Britain which is hurting and damaged, it seems, as Edmund Burke thought it was by the loss of America, but is developing the productive capacity and the tax-raising and tax-creating capacity to fight revolutionary and then Napoleonic France for 23 years and to win.
So after
the Industrial Revolution story, if you don't mind my going on,
please do.
The Industrial Revolution story comes and rescues the Great Britain, which is challenged by revolutionary France and hurting from revolutionary America.
So the British continue to fight there. They're fighting the US in the War of 1812. When do they become friends? That is the most important alliance of the last 200 years, perhaps, is the UK and the US. When do they have that rapprochement?
Comes very slowly. On the American side, there's a real sense of grudge. There's a sense of triumphalism about that little war of 1812. There's a sense of being patronized by the, you know, the larger Anglo-Saxon power all through the 19th century, a suspicion that the British might have taken advantage of the American Civil War. Had you asked any statesman in Western European diplomatic orbits of the middle and late 19th century when the next big war would come, a large number, maybe like Bismarck himself, thought it would be between America and Britain. And it's not towards the end of the 19th century when a bunch of British statesmen, obviously concerned about the other threats to the empire, are willing to make ground and concessions on various colonial border disputes, Venezuela, British Columbia with Alaska border, make concessions in the West in order to buy the goodwill of this country, which, after all, spoke our language, had our judicial system, had our system of appeal, and was our best trading and economic and investment partner. So why not stay ever more closely with them as you turn against the other rising challenges?
So 600,000 men died during the Civil War in the US between 1861 and 1865, and yet it really helps with the industrialization of the US as well. And yet the US still is not interested really in becoming an empire for another, well, 80 years or so. I mean, they still want to stay out of Europe. As you would know, Woodrow Wilson won the 1916 election with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war," and yet they were in the war, the First World War, a year after that. Why wasn't America interested in becoming an empire?
Did it need to? So, Rod, this is another great question. Let me just explain to readers the sort of methodology I've had when looking at these changes over the 500 years of history. I'm interested in tracking the relative shares of productive manufacturing efficiency, shares of world gross domestic product, leading new industries, and which particular countries are the most successful at that level of power, first of all. So what I look at, first of all, is relative economic and technological power. So that United States, Rod, which you mentioned, badly damaged by those colossal losses of blood in the North and the South in the American Civil War, and rather immediately after that is the United States, which sees the railroads crisscrossing this gigantic continent, sees the development of enormous steel industries around Pittsburgh, the development of Pennsylvania oil, the development of trade across to China. So when we get to the Woodrow Wilson period in world affairs, this president of the United States, who is trying to keep the United States out of world politics, is president of a country which, like it or not, and it liked it, had developed by far the world's greatest productive center of power. Even by 1914, the United States is something like 33% of world GDP, compared with Britain and Imperial Germany, both about 15%. Mm-hmm. So you have this weird thing in world affairs, Rod, where this like giant chimpanzee in the monkey cage, call it like that, is like sitting in the corner of the cage saying, "Don't disturb me." And the monkeys are quarreling over Balkans, over Morocco, over whatever. And it's only in 1917 that one of the monkeys, Imperial Germany, with its unrestricted U-boat warfare and attacks upon American merchantmen and American people crossing the Atlantic, provokes the giant figure in the corner of the cage to step in and come on the side of Britain and France.
And thank goodness they did. I want to get to World War One in just a moment. John is with us in North Queensland. Good morning, John.
Oh, yes. Oh, hello, Paul. The history of the last 1,200 years, as you've described, the differences between nations have been resolved by war in many occasions. Looking forward in the future, can you see a way where the differences between the major nations is not resolved by war? Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, John. So how will these differences be resolved, or will they be resolved in a different kind of war, like a trade war, and then they're not resolved?
Yeah. John, that's a really, really awfully big question. And I say awful because if the great powers don't get it right, then we're going to have another big conflict. Isn't that the threat or the concern that we all have? You know, John, after I wrote The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, I was challenged by a number of intellectuals, economic historians, to say, why don't you write a bit about transnational global trends and threats? And I wrote a book a few years after that called Preparing for the 21st Century. And then I was asked by the Office of the Secretary General of the UN if one could do a study of how a revived United Nations system, if we could ever be intelligent enough to do that, and a revived Security Council with additional membership, might create a system where the rise and fall of great powers, if it came because of altering economic trends, would not lead automatically to a big war between them. Could you use international organization, cooperation, to get things solved in through the Security Council in an amicable way and allow the nations of the world to concentrate upon these big transnational challenges to us all? Now, right now, I would say, John, that there's this uneasy tension between those of us who would like to see international machinery and cooperation solving our differences and solving our problems and challenges, so we do not need the traditional egoistic great power system. And yet, especially for those of you now in Australia looking up to the new leadership in, say, Beijing, when Professor Kennedy says egoistical great power system, it looks as if nothing really has changed. It looks as if there is a power there, a leadership there, which thinks in traditional national security and being number one ways of doing world politics.
Thanks very much, John. Paul Kennedy is our guest. If we can get to the end of World War One, there was a loser, of course, Germany. But was there a winner? No country really came out of it as this triumphant winner. I suppose, the British, they didn't lose their royal family like so many others. Their empire didn't necessarily end, although it was the beginning of the end for the British Empire at the end of World War One. Was that a war without a winner, do you think? Because obviously, the Depression came along, sort of 10 years later, partly because of what happened in World War One, and that no country really recovered from it until the 1950s.
Yeah, that war definitely was one which hurt everybody, but it's all relative. I mean, Imperial Germany was smashed, divided, reduced to a republic. France was a winner, except it had lost so much of its young men as economy and northern France devastated. It was, in material terms, a loser. Italy thought it was a winner, but it was dissatisfied with what it got, and it had lost horribly in its ranks of young men. The easiest winner, I guess, Rod, was Japan. It had come in niftily in the Far East. It had seized German colonies in North China and in the Central Pacific. It had advanced the Japanese Navy. It had managed to penetrate in its export sales in Southeast Asia. Woodrow Wilson's America was seemingly a winner, except when he got back home after the Peace of Versailles. Most Americans just wanted to turn away from a war which they thought they shouldn't have been pulled into. Russia had collapsed into a revolution and then a Bolshevik isolationism. So there weren't too many people in the 1920s going into the 1930s in the midst of that Great Depression who thought that they had been a winner in world affairs.
There was a winner in World War II, of course, and yet, and the British and the Australians, for that matter, or the Americans and the Australians really came out of that well. I know we played a relatively minor role in the war, but we were definitely there, and we really boomed in the 1950s. Why is it that some countries start an empire and others don't?
Well, you've got to remember that in this contestation among the great powers, factors like leadership, there's factors like good luck, and there's a real factor, Rod, of the good luck of geography. My word, Darwin was a real long distance away from Tokyo. Yeah. I was a very, very long distance away from Berlin. Yes, you can contribute to the war. You can send a large and increasing number of divisions to the European war and then the Pacific war. But the war can stimulate your domestic economies as it did with Australia such a great deal, like it was stimulating the American domestic economy. You can be safe apart from one air raid or two on Darwin. Australia, like the United States, is one of the combatants which never gets their cities bombed to hell.
Okay.
Everybody else does.
All right.
Probably. All right. Is that good luck or is it geography? It's a mixture. You know, it's a great place to be if you're going to fight a war in Europe, to be like 8,000 miles away and contributing from a distance.
Paul Kennedy is our guest. Just a couple of things before we go. I've got about 7 minutes before the news. So the European Union, that's a great power, isn't it? And it uses its power internally, doesn't it, rather than externally. It keeps its members together, with the obvious exception perhaps of the UK, but it doesn't expand its borders unwantedly, does it? It actually, countries want to join the European Union.
Right, I wonder how many scholars and intellectuals you've interviewed where they reply to your question, well, yes and no. If you say, well, the European Union, it's a great power, isn't it? And then Professor Kennedy says, well, yes and no. I mean, your listeners probably know the way I'm going. We're going to say that measured in terms of collective economic product, it's probably a little bit larger than the total GDP of the United States. In its population, it's bigger than the United States. In some leading industries, it's still there. And it does have increasing forms of internal harmonization, a nice Brussels word for making people all do the same thing in the right way. And it has advanced enormously in the rising standards of living of its population since the European Union was set up in 1957. But you ask if this Europe has a unified military force? The answer is no. Does this European Union have a collective, united foreign ministry with a decided foreign policy? The answer is no. So it's strong on the economic leg of being a great power, and it's weak on the military, diplomatic leg of being a great power.
Although NATO exists not as part of the European Union, but that is its military strength, is it not?
So the NATO, remember, is, the acronym comes from North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a combination of countries, two of which are on the other side of the Atlantic,
yes.
Canada and the United States, and then a significant number of original West European NATO countries expanded now to include a whole lot more in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. So you have a security organization and unity of a whole bunch of European states. You have a different organization for an economic union of so many of the states, with, in some cases, certain of the European outlier countries like Boris's Great Britain, like Norway or whatever, being in one of those organizations, but not in the other. So Europe is there decidedly. It tries to be like one of the four big powers in world affairs. Sometimes that works when you're talking about economic and trade and investment in developing countries. Other times it doesn't work.
Okay, so we've got about 3 minutes left, and that doesn't really leave you enough time to answer this one. But do you think that the next empire or the next great power is not going to be a nation state, maybe like China, but it's going to be the global tech companies that determine our futures?
It's a big question. I'm sure many of you ponder on that when you see what seems to be the role of the intrusive role of Apple or even Google in our affairs. I would say not. Maybe you would say, well, Professor Kennedy is, at the end of the day, he's a traditional great power diplomatic historian. He writes about, you know, British naval mastery, etc. So he's bound to tilt in the direction of the sovereign power of the nation states. But Rod, I would like ask you this question. If there is to be a significant breakdown in relations, say, between Japan and China, or China takes over Taiwan, or other questions some of your readers would have wanted to ask, we will be turning to ask what the State Department thinks about it.
But we will also surely see countries like the United States being brought down from the inside by the fake news, for want of a better term, being disseminated by the big tech companies.
Maybe, or maybe the powers of a nation state and the regulatory power of that state, which started in our story 500 years ago, like think of Henry VIII of England, the regulatory power of Thomas Cromwell, will just cramp the Hanseatic League, and will just cramp the big trading tech powers when it's necessary for the state to do so. If I saw the contest between traditional state power and the new power of the high-tech hybrid countries hopping from here to there, I would put my money on the state.
Are you confident for the future that the future will be better than the past?
I thought you were, are you confident in that, in my bet between the state? Now, look, I used to work in a bookie's office. I always made a side bet in the contrary direction just to be on the safe side. I'm not confident. The historian can only point to general trends and suggest where the larger possibilities are, but without not being predictive like a prophet. Hell no.
Paul, what a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, with your insights, with the stories that you've told. It's been a great, great pleasure. We're getting so many great remarks on our text line as well about how many people have enjoyed hearing what you've got to say. I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for being part of the program this morning.
Overnights with Rod Quinn
on ABC Radio.